All right, so when the covenant and the events were done at Mount Sinai, he not only made the covenant, but Moses went up into the mountain, received instructions about the building of the tabernacle and the priestly garments and the furniture and all of that. And then they broke their covenant. Yes.
I don't mean to ask you, you've talked about this so extensively. Just, what is the full significance of that divide? Because you've got quite a few, what you might call, you've got quite a few commandments, mm-hmm. kind of, you know, kind of legal aspects given in that covenant,
mm-hmm.
and then it's written down in the book.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, there are times when commandments, the Ten Commandments, are referred to as part of the law,
mm-hmm.
but yet they're originally
mm-hmm.
given in
mm-hmm.
this covenant.
Mm-hmm.
It, what specifically, I mean, do the people need to see about the distinction between this covenant? I mean, without this covenant, there's nothing else.
Yeah.
Is that true?
Yeah.
Would that be true?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So the covenant includes, in fact, the heart of the covenant is the Ten Commandments.
Okay.
The heart of the law is the Ten Commandments. In fact, many times, several times, the covenant is equated with the Ten Commandments. So, was that?
Yes, yes.
Okay. All right, so as we go on now, the directions were given and so on, the workmen appointed, you know, Bezalel, Aholiab. Then Israel breaks their covenant by making the golden calf. Now remember, what my primary interest is that you kind of monitor this and say, yeah, okay, so that goes in this period, right? In the Exodus. See, so this is a packed full period of history here. So they break their covenant, then God renews the covenant, they build the tabernacle, and they set the tabernacle up, and so on. Laws are given. By the way, you might look at the very end of the book of Leviticus. The very end of the book of Leviticus. And whoever gets to the last verse there, read that last verse.
These are the commandments which the Lord commanded Moses for the children of Israel on Mount Sinai.
See, that was at Mount Sinai. It was still, this is still at Mount Sinai. These laws that were given. So then, as you go along, all right, these laws were given. Now it doesn't specify at what point, but these would have been given in some connection with the priest, because this is very much the work of the priest. Although, as Leon would make the point, this was a book that was first taught, one of the books first taught to Jewish children, so that they could learn what was holy. So that's a very interesting thing to me. And the book of Leviticus, we should not have neglected the book of Leviticus over the years, because the book of Leviticus is the most emphatic teaching on holiness that you find in the Pentateuch. So when you think about it, when God is commanding his people, choosing his people to be a holy people, don't you think that he would need to show them what that was? Well, that's in Leviticus. So isn't it interesting how over the years we'll study everything but Leviticus, and then not we'll say, wonder why he didn't ever teach them to be holy. Well, he did. That's the book of Leviticus. So,
in our last gospel meeting, we had the two morning sessions were on the book of Leviticus, and one of the points that was made from chapter 19 that I thought was just great,
mm-hmm.
as God is giving all these laws that, you know, today we might want to throw around and try to figure out why,
yeah,
and what,
yeah.
is the purpose. And,
yeah.
But each time he just says, for I am the Lord your God.
That's right.
And it's,
I am the Lord. That's right. So I want to encourage you guys, and we'll study more, but I want to encourage you guys to give special attention to those points like that, And in the Pentateuch is a very, it's not a dry, dull, boring thing. It's only dry, dull, boring if you make it the dry, dull, and boring. It is very, very significant and foundational. And there are so many lessons that can be taught.
What's the breakdown of that word?
What word?
Pentateuch.
Penta is five. Tukas is volumes. So Pentateuch. Five volumes or five books. Okay, so all right, let me see now. We get back to the All right. So Leviticus is given while they're there. And the first census is taken while they're there at Mount Sinai. That's very, very important. So it organizes how many are in various tribes and everything, and it gives the number of the Levites, the priests, and stuff like that, and the princely offerings, and we'll break that down a little bit more just a little bit later. And so then the second Passover, the Passover, and then the substitute Passover, and then the children of Israel leave Mount Sinai. So they leave Mount Sinai. Now this is in this is like in Numbers 9, 10, or right in that context. So then they leave, and so you go Numbers 11, 12, 13. So they're going, they leave Mount Sinai, and you have the story of Taberah, the murmuring and the burning that comes among the children of Israel. Then you have the lust of the children of Israel, and they cry for meat. Our souls loathe this white bread, they said. So God says, okay, I'm going to give them meat. And so they go out and they just begin to gobble up that meat, and God smites them while the meat's still between their teeth, because the idea is that they're acting like hogs. They don't thank God. You know, we really pushed you, God. We shouldn't have done this, but you graciously gave us that. No, they didn't do anything like that. And so God just smote them. He just smote them, and they were buried. Kibroth means graves. That's the plural word for graves, kibrot, hateava, of lust, graves of lust. So it was called the graves of lust because of the lust of the children of Israel. So then you have the story of Miriam and Aaron. You know, as Miriam tries to gain more power for herself and Aaron and so on, and she's smitten with leprosy. Do you remember that? Do you guys remember that? About she's smitten with leprosy. And then they come to Kadesh Barnea. Now then, you probably already remember what is significant about Kadesh Barnea. That's right. This is the transition, see. So do you realize that we have gotten to the end of this very, very lengthy period? Not really that lengthy, but full of events. Significant, very significant. So this is the Exodus. Now we get to Numbers 13, where the spies are sent up. And then in 14... they're sentenced to wander in the wilderness. So the spies come back with their unfavorable report and their fearful report. So then they're sentenced in 14 to wander in the wilderness. So now if you were to name the events of the Exodus, don't worry if you don't name them all, every single one of them. So if I were to go back through it, I would say, the bondage of Israel, the birth and early life of Moses, the plagues, the departure from Egypt, the crossing of the Red Sea, the travel in the wilderness, Mara, to the oasis of Elam, the wilderness of Sin, and then Rephidim, where they get the water. They have the Amalekites, do the battle with the Amalekites, and then they come as they get closer to Mount Sinai. Moses' family is reunited with him, and they come on to Mount Sinai, and God appears to them. He makes the covenant with them. He gives them the law. They build the tabernacle. He gives them the priesthood. Israel breaks their covenant. God renews the covenant. They build the tabernacle. They set it up and everything like that. They have a census. They count the people there. The princely offerings are brought and everything, and they prepare to leave. They celebrate the first Passover after leaving Egypt. So the first Passover was the real one at the time of the Passover, and now this is the first commemorative Passover. So they do that, and then they depart from Mount Sinai. They go through Taberah, Kibroth Hattaavah. They go to Hazeroth. They come up to Kadesh Barnea. Now you see, that didn't take very long.
Do you ever, in any of the cycles, maybe the third cycle, do you ever use a map to show the places?
Yeah,
or?
Especially if the people don't know it. Yeah, I do that. I really do.
You don't think it's too much information to try to give them the names? And to me, it seemed like it'd be helpful.
Yeah.
Kind of trace it in the map.
Yes. So I would use a map. I guess that I tend to just use my mental map with you guys, but I would use that. Yeah, I sure would. So are you fellows able to follow your map idea, or do you think that it would be unique?
I mean, I can see the general pattern, but where all those cities
Yeah. Well, you know, when you take the tip of Mount Sinai down here, and you take that tip, you're going up sort of on the east side of Mount Sinai. And as you're traveling up here, you go up there. And, of course, you've got two fingers down here that form Mount Sinai. So one is the Gulf of Suez. The other is the Gulf of Aqaba. And Mount Sinai is that V between them. So on this right side, on the east side, is where those cities are, and then you rapidly get up beyond the head of the Gulf of Aqaba, and then you're going on up to Hazeroth and Kadesh Barnea. So Kadesh Barnea is pretty well within, it's not that far out of the land of Canaan, south of the land of Canaan.
So the mountain slope, would it come down pretty well to the coast?
Yeah.
To where they'd have to just really skirt the coast
all
the way around?
Yeah. Now, there were passes that they could take, and we don't know exactly the route. And even some of those cities, it's questionable exactly where they were. But because they do wind up at Kadesh Barnea, then I think it makes more sense. Now, there's a lot of question about exactly the route, because sometimes the idea of Ezion Geber is brought in, and that would be the head of the Gulf of Aqaba. But I don't think that it means they actually went over to Ezion Geber. I think that it means that they used a route that would lead to Ezion Geber or something like that. I don't think it means they actually went there. But anyway, if you need a map, I would get a map out. I'll get a map out if I need to. Okay. I should have had a map out.
No, I think for especially for what we're doing.
So are you able to you're able to see now?
Yeah, I can see that.
Okay, and how about you, Ted? You see it?
I was curious if in your experience.
I use a map a lot. Oh, yeah, I use a map a lot. Yes. And I'd recommend you do that when you're teaching this material. I just didn't do it because I just felt, I just thought you, you know, you knew the map well enough. But I'll be glad to have a map out here before us. if we need to do that.
Turn one in my Bible.
Yeah, okay. All right, so that they're now ready. The next period is going to be the wandering in the wilderness. Now, when I listed those events right quick, were you able to follow those in your mind pretty well? Now, using this book, it would help you to review those events and kind of get those, and you need to study those. You need to, because we're compressing a whole lot into this period here. So you need to study that any time you can and reinforce that in your mind. All right, let's go on now with the wilderness wandering. The wilderness wandering is a difficult thing to set out because it is interspersed with law. Like you have 14 in Numbers 14, which starts out with this sentence of wandering. And in 15, you have laws of drink offerings and meal offerings. Well, see, that's law. Then you have 16 and 17, which is history. Then you have 18 and 19, which is laws. So it's kind of interspersed in there. So what I do then is at this point, I don't go with the law there. All I do is say that they're sentenced to wander in the wilderness. And then after they have wandered for a long time, a lot of years have gone by, when the story of Korah, Dathan, and Abiram occurs. Now, do you know the story of Korah, Dathan, and Abiram? Do you know that story? And you know it, Lance? All right. You remember the story of Korah, Dathan, and Abiram. Do you know the story of Aaron's rod that budded and the connection with Korah, Dathan, and Abiram? You know that? Okay. Because remember, the rods of the heads of the tribes are put up by Moses, and then they go out and check, and Aaron's rod is the one that... Okay. All right. Then, do you realize that after the death of these men and all these people, the people are complaining, and they say, oh, they have destroyed God's people. Oh, they have destroyed God's people. So God just starts out. He just doesn't. No preamble. He just begins to level them. You know, often God will say, Moses, stand back. I'm going to do this. I'm going to punish the people. And Moses, no, Lord, no, no, no. He intercedes with the Lord. In this case, the Lord doesn't. No preamble. He just begins to mow them down. And they're just falling. They're just falling dead. Falling dead. Moses says, Aaron, quick, take your censer and go and intercept the progress of the plague. And he goes and it stops. And God just making the point, I am not going to be treated this way. You know. But you just marvel at Israel being so obtuse. When will they get the point? He will not be treated this way. So then you have, as the 40 years approach the end, you have the death of Miriam, you have the sin of Moses and Aaron as they speak to the rock, as they strike the rock instead of speak to the rock, and also say, you rebels, shall we bring forth water for you, and so on. And then you have the passing by of Edom and the death of Aaron. And then they are ready to begin their last approach, about a year remains. And they go up the Arabah. Remember we talked about that yesterday? Narrow, trough-like valley, 110 miles long, extending south of the Dead Sea. And so they went up that, the attack of the fiery serpents. Okay, see, that occurred, the fiery serpents. Remember the brazen serpent that Moses made and put up on a pole? See, that story occurs in here. Also, then they defeat Sihon, Og. So all of that happens. So now they have conquered the east side, the whole east side of the Jordan. They come back down to the plains of Moab, across from Jericho. And while they're there, one of the things that happens is Balaam. The story of Balaam occurs while they're there at the plains of Moab. And so that story occurs, the fornication for which Israel is smitten, losing 23,000 to 24,000 people, men. Then the second census a second census is taken. Now, are you aware of that? The second census is taken. So that one was taken at the beginning of the 40 years, now another one is taken at the end of the 40 years. So when they took that census, they discovered that all the men of war had died except Joshua and Caleb. And they also had to take this census in order to get a handle on the number of the tribe, the number of people in each tribe, because it was not long now before they're going to be dividing the land. So they needed that information. So they had that census. There's a question of Zelophehad's daughters. You know about that, Lance? Zelophehad's daughter. You know about that, Tad? What was the problem with Zelophehad's daughters?
Well, the laws only specified rules of inheritance for sons.
Yes.
Yes,
that's right.
And so a concession was made that if there were no sons, the daughters could inherit the inheritance so long as they married within the tribe.
Yeah, that was a later okay. thing that was added, but that's good. Excellent. I'm very, very, very glad. That's great.
Okay, see, I'm a little unfamiliar with that one, and I couldn't sum it up like you just did so well.
That's 27.
Right.
That's Numbers 27. Zelophehad's daughters. And they come, and I mean, I couldn't put it any better than you did. You did a real good job of summarizing that. But they came because here they are, daughters with no male heir to inherit from their father. So they come and bring up the question. And Moses does not know, and that's a good point. He does not know, so he doesn't say. Instead, he inquires of God. You know, that's a good point that you could make. That what do you do? Just pop off an answer? No, you inquire of God. You know, so I think that's a good thing. So he did that. Now later on in the book of Numbers, the question comes: What about? You know, will the inheritance of Manasseh be transferred as these women marry somebody else, and you know, from another tribe? Will it be transferred to another tribe? And so the law then said, no, what they will do is they will have to marry within their tribe. They can't marry outside of the tribe. That way it will remain in the tribe. So that was the deal. All right, then you have the vengeance of the Lord. And I like the fact that when it begins, it's the vengeance of the Lord. It's not the vengeance of Israel upon the Midianites and the Moabites, because of the they caused them to sin, they caused them to fall, they were responsible for the 23,000-24,000 people that died. So the vengeance of the Lord is taken upon them. And Reuben, Gad, and the half-tribe of Manasseh ask for land on the east side of the Jordan. So that then comes to the sermons in Deuteronomy. The sermons in Deuteronomy, preached over about a 5-week period. Now see, all of this is going on in the wandering in the wilderness, that period. And then they get ready. Moses dies. Joshua takes over the leadership. The word is given to get ready. Spies are sent over. Then they cross over the Jordan River. Jordan stops. God stops the flow of the Jordan. Memorial stones in the Jordan. Memorial stones set up at Gilgal. And then they circumcise the sons that have not been circumcised in the wilderness to roll away the reproach of Egypt. They observe the Passover, which is the 41st Passover, but it is the 40th memorial Passover. So that means that it's in the early spring, about the end of March, the 1st of April, because the month of Abib, the Hebrew months, overlapped about the last half of March, the first half of April, so that the 14th day at even would therefore be about the end of March or the 1st of April. Do you see that? You see that, Brad?
No.
All right. All right. So here's the thing. instead of being exactly parallel, their months would straddle our months, so that their month of Abib would begin like March the 15th and extend to April the 15th. So you take that 30 days and you say 14 days, which is when the Passover would be slain. You see, that would bring you to the very end of March or the very first of April, and it would vary. That's the word. It would vary exactly when that time came. It would vary so that the Passover, even on the calendar today, you will see that it varies. And apparently it varied at the time.
Did they use, this might be a, not really relevant, but did they use a lunar calendar? Or?
Yes, they did, but they had to add days. And so they would add days. When it got out of kilter, mm-hmm. they would add days. So like every 6-7 years, they would add. They would have an extra month called Adar, and so sometimes they'd have second Adar, and so they would add a few days to get things back in sync, because it would get out. You follow the lunar calendar, it will get your agricultural calendar out of sync. So they'd have to make adjustments in that. So instead of adding a day or something like that, they would just wait at a group a few days and get everything back. So this is the wandering in the wilderness, and by the time they eat the fruit of the land, the manna stops and everything, that brings an end to the wandering in the wilderness.
So I'm just thinking, as you're going through this with us,
mm-hmm.
and we know most of these stories, every now and then we need a little bit of help, but we need, if we're teaching this material, we need to be able to take any one of
you
these
need,
stories and be able to
that's
go into
exactly
more detail.
Right. That's
and
exactly right.
And as we're teaching, do like you do.
Yes.
Do you know this?
Yes.
Yes, we
exactly.
know that one. Okay. Then we won't have to worry about that one.
Yeah.
But be able to, if necessary, go into detail with every single one of the stories.
Yes. So that means that before you prepare to teach this, you need to read that, and make sure you have the stories in your mind, so that whatever they say, no, I haven't heard that one, then give them that synopsis. Remember I told you all the other day that tell it like you'd tell a child.
Yeah.
And just tell the simple story. And because you're trying to fill in the chinks and the gaps in the people with their knowledge. So you need to do that. And really be prepared to do that.
And a suggestion of mine would be one of the best ways to learn how to do it would be to teach it.
Yeah.
And
teach your children.
Even go through, a lot of times preachers will go through the Bible, and it's a good idea to preach one book for, every sermon, make it one book or something like that. So, you're gonna have a long series going through the whole Bible like that, or maybe cover one or two books. Mm-hmm. But another thing you might try to do is, instead of thinking of it in books, think of it as telling the stories.
Mm-hmm.
So just the stories
mm-hmm.
of the Bible.
Mm-hmm.
And you could make it longer or shorter,
mm-hmm.
however much
mm-hmm.
you need to. But that was something that has helped me.
Yes. Now, one thing that Adam did during the meeting here was he told the story of the Bible all the way through. Well, that's something that I have done I don't know how many times. And I'd like to encourage you guys to get to where you can tell the story of the Bible all the way through in one lesson. Now, in order to do that, you just have to study and learn. And what did you find one of the main challenges about that?
Knowing what to leave out. Knowing what to say and what not
exactly.
to say. That's the hardest thing.
Yeah, what to include, what not to include.
Yeah.
And
four,
you.
4 hours.
Yeah, but
I want to encourage you guys to do that. But especially, you need to get prepared so that when the people don't know a story, you can tell them. You can fill it in. Okay.
Is this the way you would teach this? I mean, when you're talking about your three-cycle approach, is this what you're talking about? teaching them the outline, how to put the events. Because right now, we're trying to do this through study of the Bible itself,
mm-hmm.
and then kind of teach. I don't feel like I'm having a lot of success
yeah.
teaching this to some, you know, and getting people excited about this.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not sure why that is. I'm not sure if I'm doing it wrong or, I go over all the memory work with them in class.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
then, you know, some of the teachers, they're not on board. I don't think they have any idea exactly what I'm doing.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like it could be better. I feel like we're having some success because people are studying books they've never studied before. Mm-hmm. They're like, I've never studied this. This is so interesting. But, how would you introduce it and get people to realize that this is something we can do, this is important?
Well, first of all, I wouldn't be near as compressed as I'm being with you guys.
Yeah.
And I would use maps and stuff like that. I would take my time, and I would go through that, say a couple of classes, two or three, depending on the people, to do that first one where we just link everything together, and get the people where they can say it. But I'm sorry to say that I don't know how to guarantee whether people will see the value of this or not. Part of it depends on how much they want to know the Word, how much they're into studying the Word. So I really don't know. I don't know how you can guarantee that. The thing that I have seen when there is success is that the material itself motivates the people to learn. And in what we're doing here, I would spend longer. I would spend longer. I would go easier. Make sure, and I would constantly try to refer to people and pick out things that they do know. And I would play that up. That you know this. You've heard of this, haven't you? Well, then if they say, "Well, I'm not sure I have," and then just launch in and tell it like you tell it to a child, make it an interesting story. I don't know anything else, any other way to do it, Tad. But use maps. One technique that I have found very useful in learning any list is I tell you what, I'll demonstrate that, because for me to just tell you that, I'll tell you what, I'll go ahead and tell you, but then I'm going to show you. But what I do is I put the list up. And what I'll write, like if I were going to do the 17 periods, I'd write 17, the numbers, 1 through 17 over here. So we'd go up here and we'd write the first one out, and then we'd write the second one out, and I would link them like I did and get through with that. Once I have gotten through with it, then I would say, okay, which one of these do you think we can leave out? Which one do you feel? I just ask the class generally, which one you think we could leave out? So they say, well, maybe creation, or before the flood. Okay. So I'd go up there and I'd erase that, but I'd leave the number. And then we'd say them all together. And then I would say, okay, now then, what's another one that you feel like we can leave out? So somebody else will pick another one out, so we'll erase that one. And every time you say the whole list through, and when you get through, everybody will be able to see the whole thing with only the numbers up there. That's an excellent technique for learning Judges, Apostles, anything like that. Excellent technique. It really is a good way to do it. But I don't know what else to tell you. Make it as interesting as you can. Make the stories come alive. Let them see your excitement. Let them see your excitement in learning this. Help them, you know, like I did at first, help them see the value. That this is not the end of the thing. This is just the beginning. You're learning tools so that your Bible knowledge will be more accessible to you. So that's the kind of thing that, you know, it's kind of like a selling thing. You're not trying to sell people something that they don't need. You're trying to create an appreciation for what they're going to learn. So
I feel like I've got a lot of students that don't know how to study.
Yes.
Unless they have questions. And they, as we're doing this, the group has asked me to make questions. And I feel like that you know, people are just studying to answer those questions.
Yeah.
They're not great questions because, I mean.
Yeah.
You know, and we're making these questions, and, you know, people feel like they've studied that they can answer the questions.
Well, one thing you could do, I would do things like give them a sheet out with the 17 periods, except I'd leave some of them out, several of them out,
mm-hmm.
and say, okay, now you fill in this, and you can fill it in class as we go through it, and then give them another one and leave different ones out. And so try to do some things like that. But I sympathize with you. I have spent my life trying to help people overcome the poorest teaching methods known to man. And I think the church has historically used the poorest teaching methods known to man.
Well, Ian gave me the audio of your teaching, and I've tried to do some of the same things.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that I've heard you talk about several times is just how, even if you're writing, take it that's creating a disconnect between you and the.
Yeah.
I think one of the funniest ones was I think you had Donald up writing the periods, and you stopped and said, "Now you can watch him write those, but if you do, you're not gonna get what I'm saying." And so that's, you know, we gave him the books, but I told him don't look at the books, don't take notes, just listen.
Right.
And we'll
right.
Through it. And it's,
try to get it fixed in your mind.
But if you have people that are rebelling against that,
You just have to do what you have to do. You know, I mean, all of us understand that. You have to adapt to the people, the students you have.
I wonder sometimes if they feel like if I'm doing something wrong, because they've asked me these questions and I gave them some questions for each lesson. But I never answer their questions. I never answer those questions.
I don't care anything
about those questions. I don't ever. I was going to see if you could maybe kind of give him the illustrations, because I've tried to present it several times, and sometimes I've gotten positive feedback. Other times I've wondered, what did I do wrong?
Mm-hmm.
And the one thing that really stuck out was when you tell them, like, you're not selling a package, but you're selling
yes.
benefit.
Yes.
So explain to him how you sell the benefit. Once here's the end game. When you get to the end.
Yes.
You know, what we're going to do is going to be able to very easily outline your Bible.
Yeah. You see, already I can show you, illustrate what he's talking about. But it's a little hard to do that until they have gotten a little bit of a taste of it. But what you will be able to do is you will be able to, if you need to know, you need to go read something, you'll know where to go read it. You'll know within a few chapters. You'll know within a few chapters where to go to read this. Is that?
Yeah, I mean, if somebody, I think you said something simple that everybody would know. Like,
yeah.
If somebody asked you, you know, where in the Bible does it say that Satan took the form of a serpent?
Yeah.
You'd say, well,
yeah.
That's before the flood. And
yeah.
You know, right there in chapter 3.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. So you'd say, okay, where did Satan appear as a serpent? Where was that? Okay, it was Genesis 3.
Right.
See.
Instead of having to go to a concordance or miss an opportunity.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
Because that's what we do with, like, that vase. You started out with a vase, put it in a box. That's what we do with our Bible knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I know the Bible says something about the seed of Abraham, talking about that's Christ.
Mm-hmm.
I just don't know where it's at. Where is that at? And then you miss an opportunity.
Yeah.
But if you've got it in that compartment, in that box, you can retrieve it.
Mm-hmm. As we go along, I'll be making more points that I think will help. But I'll go further. I'll have to go a little bit further to fully be able to illustrate.
That's fine. And I think that maybe, you know, quite a few people are getting a taste, but they're
just
taste. They don't have an idea what the meal is.
You just hang in. You hang in there through this week, and then I think you'll have more ammunition.
I can get to that audio of him teaching it, and that has helped me tremendously to to be able to teach it.
Yeah, so that would be good if you could just get the audio. I don't guarantee that I could do it with the group that you're facing, but maybe that would help. Maybe that would help.
Are you teaching it to young people?
Or everybody's studying it.
Everybody's studying it.
That's great.
Have you personally had experience teaching it to younger people? You know, elementary, junior high.
I've taught it to high schoolers.
Mm. Well, that wasn't an experience for me. Teaching it to kids, because that's a lot more challenging than teaching it to adults.
Mm.
For one thing, they don't have a base of knowledge that the adults have.
Right. Right.
For another thing, you know, you kind of have to get into it a little bit more.
Yeah.
So with kids, my advice would be get excited.
Mm-hmm.
Just, you know, tell the stories with a lot of enthusiasm. Practice the story before the class so that when you tell it, you're putting emphasis in there.
Yes.
You know, you're showing emotion in your face
That's
and
right.
the inflection of your voice.
That's right.
Kids love stories.
And
the Bible
is
full of magnificent stories. And when I preach, the story of Jonah, the kids pay attention more than ever.
Yeah, that's
when you tell stories. But you got to tell it with the passion.
Yes, that's right.
And like you said, adults need it the same way the kids need it. It'll wrap their attention if you really do it right. They'll love this material.
That's right. So hang in there, and we'll see how things are going by the end of the week. And maybe you can get that audio, and that'll help. Well, listen, before we go before Leon gets here, the next period is going to be the invasion and conquest. Now, you know, the other day I told you about the central campaign, the southern campaign, the northern campaign. Now, see, that would involve a map, if you can envision the map. Central campaign, southern campaign, northern campaign, and then the dividing of the land. The Transjordanic tribes go back home. Now see, I'm skipping over the altar of offense. Now you know about the altar of offense? Good. I'm pleased with you guys. You know anything about the altar of offense? How about you, Brad? You know it? Okay. When they went back home, when the Transjordanic tribes went back home, they built this monumental altar. And you need to read it closely, because they didn't build a normal size altar. They built a monumental altar, because that's one of the points they made, that it is not to be used for sacrifice, but it is to be used as a monument. Meaning that when the time comes, if your children say, you have no part, you're not one of us, then there's that altar. And that would be a reminder. And so when they did that and explained it to Joshua and everything, then it was okay. It was okay. So they went back home. And then you have the farewell addresses of Joshua. Two speeches that he makes. So the primary thing is to remember the central campaign, the southern campaign, the northern campaign, the dividing of the land among the tribes, and then the Transjordanic tribes go back home, and the farewell speeches of Joshua. See? Now that's really what you need to know. There. That goes in that box. So anything about the conquering of the land of Canaan goes in that box. So Jericho, the experience with the Gibeonites, that goes in that story. Because the Gibeonites, that forms a kind of a transition between the central campaign and the southern campaign. Because the Gibeonites are approached by the southern kings to fight with them, and they won't fight with them, and so that brings the Israelites to the aid of the Gibeonites, which brings them then in conflict with those southern kings.
And would you say it's better to view that aspect as sort of circumstantial instead of this idea, well, it was the strategy that made their conquest successful. You know, the idea, you know, I read guys talk about how that was a very strategic move to divide the land the way they did. By that doesn't matter.
No, I agree. I think they went into that central because they crossed the northern end of the Dead Sea. Well, when they crossed the northern end of the Dead Sea, that happened smack in the center of the country. And so that was the very first thing in front of them. So they took Jericho because it guarded the main road up into the highland there. So they had to conquer it. And so then that involved Ai and the campaign up there and everything like that.
How close was the original city of Jericho to Jericho of the New Testament?
I probably can. In fact, the ruins of Jericho are still there. So the ruins of Jericho are still there, and it occupies about 7 acres. Leon,
you're asking in regard to New Testament Jericho.
Yeah.
New Testament Jericho is about a mile south of the ancient site.
So it's pretty close.
Yeah. Oh, pretty close. All right, so we're going to let that go now, okay? And I'll see you all after a while then. See you back here at lunch.
Thank you, sir.
Okay.
Thank you.